Welcome to Poetry Lectures, a series of lectures by poets, scholars, and educators, presented by PoetryFoundation.org. In this program, we hear two-term poet laureate Billy Collins speaking at the Key West Literary Seminar. Often called the most popular poet in America, Billy Collins is known for his accessible and engaging style. He writes about everyday moments, objects, and scenes, and about reading and writing and poetry itself. He's managed the rare feat of gaining respect from a large audience of general readers and literary insiders alike. Billy Collins was born in 1941 in New York City. After earning his Ph.D. from the University of California, Riverside, he co-founded the Mid-Atlantic Review with Michael Shannon. It was Collins' fourth book, Questions About Angels, published in 1991, that brought him national attention. Since then, he has written several best-selling books of poetry, performed at sold-out readings across the country, and appeared frequently on National Public Radio. As poet laureate, Collins created Poetry 180, an anthology for teaching poetry in high schools. The program is available for free online. The Key West Literary Seminar was founded in 1983 and is dedicated to the celebration of the written word and the support of American writers. Each January, the seminar hosts an international gathering of readers and writers in Key West, Florida. In 2010, Billy Collins gave this talk entitled, Dear Reader. In it, he reads from his own and other poems and explores the intimacy created in some poems between writer and reader. Here is Billy Collins.
You notice maybe in the program that my appearance has a title, Dear Reader, and I was asked not just to read poems, but to present a kind of meditation on this ghostly figure that we all seem to imagine as we write. But I start with an anecdote. A friend of mine that always stuck with me, a friend of mine was walking along Madison Avenue, let's say, with the New Yorker writer Roger Angel, and one of the great sports writers of America, who's the baseball season never really ends until you read his roundup of it. It's like they say, with the game never ends until the fat lady sings the song. I don't know, I've never seen a fat lady sing a song at the end of any game, but the baseball season doesn't end until you read Roger Angel's roundup of it. And someone recognized Angel and stopped him and began to just flatter him about his writing and tell him what a great writer he was. And then my friend and Angel continued to talk, and they walked about a block, and Angel said to my friend, "That's what it's all about." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "That's what writing is all about." He says, "What?" He says, "The love of strangers." And which is a sort of neuroses. Most people are satisfied with the love of people around them, although that love tends to be insufficient at most times. Whereas writers seem to court the love of total strangers, and I am probably more guilty than anybody. I tend to begin each of my books with a prefatory poem that's actually addressed to the reader, and it's my way of acknowledging the presence of the reader. And I think as I'm reading contemporary poetry, I tend to they tend to fall into two categories for me, which are sort of undefinable. But in one category, I feel that the poet is aware of my presence. And in the other, I feel that an act of typewriting or someone is committing an act of literature, oblivious to my participation in it. You might call these two kinds dogs and cats. You know, dogs are really interested in people, as you know, whereas cats are much more self-referential. And I think of Maxine's lovely poem about her dog, Virgil. But I think of the poem as a social encounter. Borges said that the flavor lies not in the fruit, but in its contact with the palate. And so that the poem exists not as a set of typed letters in a book, but it is completed in the mind of the reader. So let me read one of these prefatory poems. It has an epigraph from Yeats, who said, in his rather ascendancy or equestrian attitude toward life. He said, "A poet never speaks directly as to someone at the breakfast table." And this poem takes issue with that chilliness. It's called A Portrait of the Reader with a Bowl of Cereal. "Every morning I sit across from you at the same small table, the sun all over the breakfast things, curve of a blue and white pitcher, a dish of berries, me in a sweatshirt or robe, you invisible. Most days we are suspended over a deep pool of silence. I stare straight through you or look out the window at the garden, the powerful sky, a cloud passing behind a tree. There is no need to pass the toast, the pot of jam, or pour you a cup of tea, and I can hide behind the paper, rotate in its drum of calamitous news. But some days I may notice a little door swinging open in the morning air, and maybe the tea leaves of some dream will be stuck to the china slope of the hour. Then I will lean forward, elbows on the table, with something to tell you, and you will look up, as always, your spoon dripping milk, ready to listen." It's a rather... and this is another poem which is shamelessly courting the attention of readers, and it's simply called "You Reader." "I wonder how you are going to feel when you find out that I wrote this instead of you. That it was I who got up early to sit in the kitchen and mention with a pen the rain-soaked windows, the ivy wallpaper, and the goldfish circling in its bowl. Go ahead and turn aside, bite your lip and tear out the page. But listen, it was just a matter of time before one of us happened to notice the unlit candles and the clock humming on the wall. Plus, nothing happened that morning. A song on the radio, a car whistling along the road outside, and I was only thinking about the shakers of salt and pepper that were standing side by side on a placemat. I wondered if they had become friends after all these years, or if they were still strangers to one another, like you and I, who managed to be known and unknown to each other at the same time. Me at this table with a bowl of pears, you leaning in a doorway somewhere near some blue hydrangeas reading this." I guess you could describe my relationship to the reader as a kind of codependency, or it's a dependency in which I hope the co part is being added by the reader. I think it's sort of absurd to say you write for a reader, because as you're composing a poem, even you haven't read it yet, so, you know, it's not done, so how can you envision a reader? But I have a sense that as I'm composing, that I kind of go back and forth from being writer to reader and writer to reader. You know, if I write a stanza or a sentence or some unit, you know, I think I just instinctively go back and reread that as if I were somebody else, not me. And I think a lot of the poems I don't enjoy reading are written by people who have a really hard time pretending to be anyone but themselves. And it's that kind of checking, you know, the self-expressive urges of oneself against a more objective fellow who picks up a book in a bookstore in Minnesota, and, you know, there's your poem, and who is that person? If you've been to Catholic school, your guardian angel is probably the closest thing to a reader, or at least it provides you with a rather benign sense of who that reader might be. But we were talking, many of the discussions on the panels here revolved around the whole idea of form. And form, of course, is sociable. I mean, form is what includes the reader. Readers of poetry come to poetry because they're interested in the poet. They come there because they're interested in poetry. And when I talk to people in workshops, I tell them that that no one cares about you, basically. That the act, that self-expression is wildly overrated. People care about poetry. So if in your poem you can present the illusion that you are more interested in poetry than you are in yourself, which is an illusion, or a lie, then there's a way to make contact with the reader, right? And what gives readers pleasure is basically that huge word form, you know, which can be, and I would make the case also for so-called free verse having formal properties. You know, they're differently construed. So I want the companionship of a reader, and I think, I don't know, when I was reading, you know, as a student reading Shakespeare and Tennyson and John Donne and Herbert, I never found that they were talking to me. I felt that I was visiting a shrine. You know, these poems were shrines that thousands of people had visited before, and I was showing up with my crutches, you know, hoping to be saved. Until I read Whitman, and Whitman was the first person that gave me this sort of chill, because he seemed to be complete, not only aware of my existence, but aware of what I was doing that day. You know, that great passage in the Crossing Brooklyn Ferry where he says, you know, as I stood here, you will stand here, and as I don't have the lines, obviously, but as you see the water running or then seagulls passing, you will see them, I have seen them, I know you're there. And it's very chilling to have that kind of intimacy. And I think that's something I've tried to bring into my poetry. Most of my poems don't have anyone in other people in them. There are very few. There are no uncles or it's a very low occupancy. You know, they have those signs in public buildings, you know, of maximum occupancy 400 or whatever. I think in a lyric poem the maximum occupancy is 2, me and the reader, you know. And the fewer people you have in your poem, the more alone you can be with the reader. And I want to be completely alone with the reader. At the same time, I want to get ahead of the reader. You know, I don't want to... I think I want to start off on the same foot with the reader, but I want the poem to get a little ahead of me and therefore ahead of the reader. But let me read a poem. It's a poem in which I try to achieve some kind of direct intimacy with an imagined self. And it's called Directions. And I actually saw in a museum in Dublin, I saw a book of poems open under a glass case, and it was giving directions, and I thought I'd just steal that whole idea. Because we all know that that's a form of address. If someone asks you, how do you get to this theater, well, you will ask them how much they know. You know, do you know where Duval Street is? And then at some point, their knowledge trails off and your knowledge kicks in. Directions. You know the brick path in back of the house, the one you see from the kitchen window, the one that bends around the far end of the garden where all the yellow primroses are? And you know how if you leave the path and walk up into the woods, you come to a heap of rocks probably pushed down during the horrors of the Ice Age, and a grove of tall hemlocks, dark green now, against the light brown fallen leaves. And farther on, you know the small footbridge with the broken railing. And if you go beyond that, you arrive at the bottom of that sheep's head hill. Well, if you start climbing, and you might have to grab hold of a sapling when the going gets steep, you will eventually come to a long stone ridge with a border of pine trees, which is as high as you can go and a good enough place to stop. The best time is late afternoon when the sun strobes through the columns of trees as you are hiking up, and when you find an agreeable rock to sit on, you will be able to see the light pouring down into the woods and breaking into the shapes and tones of things, and you will hear nothing but a sprig of birdsong or the leafy falling of a cone through the trees, and if this is your day, you might even spot a hare or feel the wing beats of geese driving overhead towards some destination. But it is hard to speak of these things, how the voices of light enter the body and begin to recite their stories, how the earth holds us painfully against its breast, made of hummus and brambles, how we who will soon be gone regard the entities that continue to return, greener than ever, spring water flowing through the meadow, and the shadows of clouds passing over the hills and the ground where we stand in the tremble of thought, taking the vast outside into ourselves. Still, let me know before you set out. Come knock on my door, and I will walk with you as far as the garden, with one hand on your shoulder. I will even watch after you and not turn back to the house until you disappear into the crowd of maple and ash, heading up toward the hill, piercing the ground with your stick. Thank you. But I also want to be, you know, I think probably to go with that cat and dog analogy a little farther, we're probably part cat and part dog, if you can imagine such a hideous creature. I think in some cases my poems start out being dog-like and end up being cat-like, you know, it begins as a sort of social encounter, but I end up just wanting to rub against the chair and forget the reader. And I want to be, I don't want to be a completely reliable person either. I'd rather be a slightly untrustworthy. This is a poem called Fishing on the Susquehanna in July. I have never been fishing on the Susquehanna, or in any river for that matter, to be perfectly honest. Not in July or any month have I had the pleasure, if it is a pleasure, of fishing on the Susquehanna. I am more likely to be found in a quiet room like this one, a painting of a woman on the wall, a bowl of tangerines on the table, trying to manufacture the sensation of fishing on the Susquehanna. There is little doubt that others have been fishing on the Susquehanna, rowing upstream in a wooden boat, sliding the oars under the water, then raising them to drip in the light. But the nearest I have ever come to fishing on the Susquehanna was one afternoon in a museum in Philadelphia, when I balanced a little egg of a time in front of a painting in which that river curled around a bend under a blue cloud-ruffled sky, dense trees along the banks, and a fellow with a red bandana sitting in a small green flat-bottomed boat holding the thin whip of a pole. That is something I am unlikely ever to do, I remember saying to myself and the person next to me. Then I blinked and moved on to other American scenes of haystacks, water whitening over rocks, even one of a brown hare who seemed so wired with alertness, I imagined him springing right out of the frame. I think it's Mark Strand's image of that you don't want to play secretary to yourself. You don't want to just take your thoughts and feelings and take dictation. You want the pen to be an instrument of discovery and not just a recording device. And in that sense, every poem is sort of a journey towards some destination that, to quote somebody else earlier yesterday, that is sort of unforeseeable but inevitable. There's a kind of inevitability about the discovery. And I suppose that rabbit, you know, that hare in that painting was the whole reason for that poem. I mean, I didn't envision that in the beginning, but that's what the poem ended up traveling to in its own cat-like way. So I'll read another poem that maybe has a bit of that kind of travel in it, and it's a poem called The Trouble with Poetry. It's not that long a poem, don't worry, because it doesn't talk about all the trouble with poetry, just some of the trouble with poetry. The trouble with poetry. The trouble with poetry, I realized as I walked along a beach one night, cold Florida sand under my feet, a show of stars in the sky. The trouble with poetry is that it encourages the writing of more poetry More guppies crowding the fish tank. More baby rabbits hopping out of their mothers into the dewy grass. And how will it ever end unless the day finally arrives when we have compared everything in the world to everything else in the world? And there is nothing left to do then but quietly close our notebooks and sit with our hands folded on our desks. Poetry fills me with joy, and I rise like a feather in the wind. Poetry fills me with sorrow, and I sink like a chain flung from a bridge. But mostly, poetry fills me with the urge to write poetry, to sit in the dark and wait for a little flame to appear at the tip of my pencil. And along with that, the longing to steal, to break into the poems of others with a flashlight and a ski mask. And what an unmerry band of thieves we are, cut purses, common shoplifters, I thought to myself as a cold wave swirled around my feet and the lighthouse moved its megaphone over the sea, which is an image I stole directly from Lawrence Ferlinghetti. To be perfectly honest for a moment, the bicycling poet of San Francisco, whose little amusement park of a book I used to carry in a side pocket of my uniform up and down the treacherous halls of high school. So I think the last thing on my mind when I started that poem was Lawrence Ferlinghetti, but I was, when he appeared, I was just so relieved that that he was providing me with a way to stop writing that poem, a way to end it. You know, because you know when we study poetry, we say this poem is about grief and this poem is about celebration. But when you're writing a poem, it's just about how to end it. You know, how do you stop? How do you come to a point where you don't want to say anything more and no one wants to hear anything more? Well, this is a poem in which I suppose try to create a confidentiality with the reader, imparting, in fact, to the reader the secrets of poetic composition. It's called Purity. My favorite time to write is in the late afternoon, weekdays, particularly Wednesdays. This is how I go about it. I take a fresh pot of tea into my study and close the door. Then I remove my clothes and leave them in a pile, as if I had melted to death, and my legacy consisted only of a white shirt, a pair of pants, and a pot of cold tea. Then I remove my flesh and hang it over the chair. I slide it off my bones like a silken garment. I do this so that what I write will be pure, completely rinsed of the carnal, uncontaminated by the preoccupations of the body. Finally, I remove each of my organs and arrange them on a small table near the window. I do not want to hear their ancient rhythms when I am trying to tap out my own drumbeat. Now, I sit down at the desk, ready to begin. I am entirely pure, nothing but a skeleton at a typewriter. I should mention that sometimes I leave my penis on. I find it difficult to ignore the temptation. Then I am a skeleton with a penis at a typewriter. In this condition, I write extraordinary love poems, most of them exploiting the connection between sex and death. I am concentration itself. I exist in a universe where there is nothing but sex, death, and typewriting. After a spell of this, I remove my penis too. Then I am all skull and bones, typing into the afternoon, just the absolute essentials, no flounces. Now I write only about death, most classical of themes, in a language light as the air between my ribs. Afterward, I reward myself by going for a drive at sunset. I replace my organs and slip back into my flesh and clothes. Then I back the car out of the garage and speed through woods on winding country roads, passing stone walls, farmhouses, and frozen ponds, all perfectly arranged like words in a famous sonnet. and I'll read. Thank you. So I just read one more poem, and I think it's a little poem called Envoy, and it's trying to be part of that tradition, medieval, I think, in origin, where the author, at the end of his book, bids goodbye to the book. And at the end of Chaucer's Troilus and Cressida, he says, "Go, little book, go, mine tragedy," and sends his book off into the world. Envoy. Go, little book, out of this house and into the world. Carriage made of paper, rolling toward town, bearing a single passenger, beyond the reach of this jittery pen, far from the desk and the nosy gooseneck lamp. It is time to decamp, put on a jacket, and venture outside. Time to be regarded by other eyes, bound to be held in foreign hands. So off you go, infants of the brain, with a wave and some bits of fatherly advice. Stay out as late as you like. Don't bother to call or write, and talk to as many strangers as you can. Thank you.
That was Billy Collins speaking at the Key West Literary Seminar on January 9, 2010. You can learn more about the seminar at kwls.org. Collins' recent books include The Trouble with Poetry and Ballistics. He also edited Bright Wings, an illustrated anthology of poems about birds, published in 2009. You can read more about Billy Collins and many of his poems at poetryfoundation.org. You'll also find many other articles about poets and poetry, an online archive of more than 9,000 poems, and other audio programs to download. I'm Ed Herman. Thanks for listening to Poetry Lectures from poetryfoundation.org.